Football Weekly is on the air.
Hi, I'm Hub Arkish, and along with Eric Edholm, it is our great pleasure to bring you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly, where every week we bring you everything there is to know about the National Football League, both on and off the field.
We continue our roundtable discussion on the latest lockout news, and we give updates on Plaxico Burress, Colt McCoy, and Albert Haynesworth.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Hello to everybody, and thank you so much for joining us for another week of Pro Football Weekly, where every week we bring you everything there is to know about the National Football League, on the field, off the field, unfortunately most of it off the field these days, but we've got all the latest for you. I'm Hub Arkish, the publisher and editor. My co-host is our senior editor, Eric Edholm. We will also be joined by the entire Pro Football Weekly editorial department during the course of the next hour or so, and we kick the show off along with another one of our senior editors, Mike Wilkening, and associate editor Dan Parr, as we try and bring you up to date on what's going on with the labor impasse, the lockout. You'll notice that the crew has grown in these segments the last couple weeks, has reached the point now where even though there's nothing happening, there's so much going on that we've got experts on all these different subjects. And guys, I want to start by making sure that our listeners understand something. You've got a bunch of different media outlets trying to get credit for breaking stories and continuing to report these, quote, secret meetings going on between the players and the owners. There is nothing secret about these meetings. They are being attended by Chief Magistrate Judge Fred Boylan, who is the mediator appointed by Judge Susan Nelson in the 8th District up in Minneapolis. This is the mediation that she's insisted on as she continues to let the antitrust suit wend its way through her courts. And the fact that they're not announcing in advance where they're going to be is people acting like there's some big secret here. Now, of course, it's good that they're talking. It's good that there are fewer lawyers and more owners and players in the room. But there's also no progress being made. And so, Eric, every time somebody hears, oh, there was a secret meeting, people get excited. Folks, so far, this is nothing to get excited about.
Yeah, I think the media has sort of confused us a little bit in the sense that, like you said, they're not making a big dog and pony show. But they are releasing statements afterwards saying that we are meeting and we're continuing to meet. So I think progress is a relative term. People I've talked to have been very hush-hush about what's going on. I suppose that's a good thing. I mean, I suppose that, you know, the less that's said, the fewer these egos can be bruised. But, you know, two names that weren't there, no Jeff Pasch, no Jeffrey Kessler, the two appointments, so to speak, the negotiators who've riled up both sides so much. So it appears like they were trying to repair this relationship just a little bit.
Well, those two very much lightning rods. Also interesting to note that new in the room this week, Clark Hunt, a newer owner from the Kansas City Chiefs. Not in the room, Jerry Jones of the Dallas Cowboys. Again, Jones is going to be a key figure in this thing all the way, but another one of a bit of a lightning rod that I think some owners feel they've got to get away from these players because he really does tend to rile up the bad feeling, and I think both sides now realize they've got to get that out of the room. Wilkie, I will turn to you to comment on something Eric just said, which I think is interesting. Again, what media folks are trying to report as some big hush-hush secret is the reality that both Judge Nelson and Chief Magistrate Boylan have a gag order on these mediation sessions, and the reason that they're keeping it so hush-hush is that they don't want the media and fans to know what's going on because they don't want this roller coaster ride of emotions. And you know, Mike, it's the one thing they're doing a pretty good job on as far as the gag order and not letting a lot get out of these meetings.
Right. And look, I mean, if a federal judge, and a mediator, you know, says there's a gag order, I think it's best to follow such things. And I think as it stands right now, the less information, the less that is said about these things just speaks to the sensitivity of negotiations. And again, you know, I think to sort of speak to the point of these meetings, you know, whether they're called secret or not, again, the fact that there is FaceTime between the principals, whether it, you know, is part of the mediation process or not, I think is a good thing because, again, we're not going to get agreement unless the sides are meeting.
Last Friday, both sides had their day in court in front of the three-judge appellate bench in St. Louis in the 8th District, hearing the question of whether the lockout is legal or not. Now, these judges have put a permanent stay on the lockout until they rule on the owner's appeal. The owners are asking the appellate court to overturn Judge Susan Nelson's ruling that the lockout is illegal and should be lifted. We've had early indications indications just in the ruling of the permanent stay that these judges might look favorably upon the owners, but nothing could really be taken from the hearing last Friday. It was actually relatively short, just over an hour, and it was interesting, Dan Parr, that at the end of the hearing, it was Judge Kermit Bai, the judge who ruled strongly in opposition to the permanent stay on the injunction, felt that the lockout should be lifted, according to Judge Nelson's ruling, warned both sides, and you better get back together and work this out, because if we're asked to finally rule, which we will do in due course, neither side is going to like that ruling. Now, Dan, I'm hard-pressed to see what they could do that neither side would like. I think whatever they do based on their limited options, one side's going to feel better about it than the other. But we continue to hear, even from these judges, that they want these people to work it out themselves, and I think it's more than anything because the law is so ambiguous in so many of these issues.
And the message has been received, from what we can tell. They're meeting now on a somewhat regular basis. They intend to keep meeting. It's a positive step. So whatever leverage game is still being played in terms of waiting to see what the latest court ruling is, it seems like everyone's wish that they would get away from that kind of perspective, that way of looking at things, is perhaps coming to fruition, which is obviously great for the league and everyone who follows it. But now they're on the clock. Some people say July 4th is the date. Some people say July 15th is the date. What is the date going to be where they have to get a deal done so they don't lose out on preseason time? It's going to take a few weeks for these negotiations to get to a serious point, at least a few weeks, where they get to a serious point where a deal is close to being done. So we still have some time to go here, and they definitely are on the clock.
And it's interesting to hear Dan use the word leverage, because that, in fact, is what all of these hearings, all these court cases, all this litigation are about. It's each side trying to gain leverage to force the other side to start to bend a little bit and give a deal that one side is going to feel good about and that the other side can at least tolerate. Now, one other big piece of news this week, the owners were back in the Eighth Circuit in front of Judge Nelson this past week, asking her to drop the players' antitrust suit, asking her to kick it out of court, saying it's without merit. She did give us one piece of information that sent everybody running for the headlines. We're going to take a very quick commercial break here, and we're back to follow up on that as well as more as we give you everything you need to know to keep up with the current NFL labor impasse. We're back in just a moment. Back with more Pro Football Weekly. Hub Arkish, Eric Edholm, Mike Wilkening, and Dan Parr, all of the Pro Football Weekly editorial department, bringing you up to speed on everything that's happened this past week in the NFL labor impasse. And I mentioned just before the commercial break, the NFL owners were back in court in Minneapolis. They've asked Judge Nelson to throw the players' antitrust suit out of court, saying it's without merit. She gave an interesting response. She listened to their argument, gave the players their dates and deadlines as to when they needed to file their response, and said she would hear the owners' argument on September 12th. Well, once again, guys, that sent a bunch of headline writers running for their typewriters, or I guess we're all at keyboards now. The start of the NFL season is in jeopardy. She won't rule until September 12th. The season's supposed to start September 8th. Wilkie, one has nothing to do with the other. I mean, they can certainly start the season with the antitrust suit still in place. Now, if she were to drop the suit, it would be another big piece of leverage for the owners, but it's probably the least important thing that's going on right now, and the fact that she's not going to hear that argument until September 12th really has nothing to do with the lockout or the impasse at the moment. As a matter of fact, everybody's hoping that the two sides can get a deal, in which case the suit would be dropped anyway.
Right. That's the idea. Coming to an agreement of some sort before this gets kicked further along in the court system. And another note, too, the hearing actually on Wednesday was moved up to August 29th. So we don't even have that fake doomsday sort of start of the regular season scenario anyways. Hub, you've hit on the right point here. If it gets done before we get to the courts, it's going to get done at the negotiating table. And the hope everybody has is that it gets done sometime in the summer before July, so we can have a regular preseason and regular season and all of those things. That's just another sort of procedural thing down the road here.
And keep in mind, folks, and Wilkie, thank you, because I was not aware that they'd move the hearing up until August 29th, but what we've all learned, as we've all become backroom lawyers of sorts, is that doesn't really matter, because she's not going to rule from the bench. And so even if the hearing is on August 29th, it's going to be weeks after that before she makes a decision on that particular point. Now, Dan, the one piece that nobody seems to be talking about, to me, is really the most critical. critical, because we also know that there was a hearing almost 2 weeks ago in Judge David Doty's court, which was the damages portion of the suit that the players have filed against the owners for, illegally, there's no other way to say it, negotiating their network TV contracts in 2008 against the best interest of the players. Now, Judge Doty has already ruled in favor of the players, in fact, has used words like egregious in describing the owners' behavior in this particular negotiation. This was the damages portion, and what the players have asked is, A, that that money, that $4 billion in network TV revenue that is supposed to be advanced to the owners during the 2011 season, even the event of a lockout, be escrowed and that money not be given to the owners, number one. Number two, the players have asked for $707 million in damages. Now, we know that Doty has ruled in favor of the players. If he were to make a significant damages award in favor of the players, or if he simply agrees to escrow the money and doesn't even give the players damages, that is a huge leverage win for the players. And of all the things we're waiting on, that may be the most important right now.
It is a big piece of leverage in this whole game that's been going on and on. But to me, if the players are really banking on that, if they thought that $707 million was the key, if that was part of their strategy, and if D'Amore Smith was convinced that knowing Judge Doty and the way he's ruled in the past, that was something they could, players could bank on, and that he would rule in their favor again, I'm not sure that they'd be at the negotiating table right now. So I think they, certainly this is something they're watching, and it's not out of mind, but it seems like they feel like the time to make a deal is now, and not to wait for that ruling.
Well, and Eric, Dan makes a great point here, but that's the reason that both sides are at the table.
Yep.
Because neither side knows how these two key issues are going to go. Is the TV money going to be put away where nobody can touch it? Is the lockout going to be in place or not? It makes sense for both sides to be at the table not knowing the outcome. As soon as either one of these rulings comes down, whichever side it favors probably walks away from the table for a little while.
Right, even if it isn't the whole $707 million. I mean, I don't see Doty giving the entire amount, but like you said, even if he doesn't award a dollar, even if that money is shelved, that's money the owners can't have. And guess what? If you cancel the preseason or cut into the preseason, that's, you know, tens and hundreds of millions of dollars. It could be a $1 billion loss if they wipe out the entire preseason. So, I mean, there's so much money potentially lost in this whole situation. And, you know, the owners, I think, also sort of let the story float about a possible 8-game schedule. Ooh, let's get everybody all riled up and what the potential losses would be for that. That's also to sort of counterbalance a little bit what's going on with this Doty money.
Well, guys, I got to tell you, I didn't believe it until last week, but I've come to the conclusion in the last week or 10 days that these sides are now dug in too deep. Forget September 8th. I don't see the season starting on time. That's just a prediction. That's no news that I have to offer. But I think it's logical. If you look at where we're at right now, these two sides have got themselves back so deep into corners that there's no way to get out. They don't really have good options right now. We're going to need either a big change of heart from the owners. They're going to have to give the players something they weren't willing to give them, or a dramatic ruling from one of these judges to get this thing moving again. Now, one other subject I want to get into here is, what about the impact that this lockout is having on the game, forgetting the financial aspect of it? What is it doing to these teams? What is it doing to these players? Former Cleveland Browns coach Eric Mangini was on the NFL Network this week, and he had some interesting comments on what it is that is happening to these teams and how difficult it's going to be for them to get ready for the 2011 season.
There's 25 new coordinators and 8 new head coaches. For those new coordinators and new head coaches, you don't really know your team. You don't know the guys that you have, so it's hard to plan and anticipate what you're going to be able to use early on in the season, what strengths and weaknesses your guys have. And even though you know the rookies to some extent because you did your research on them, you don't really have a sense of what they can do. And that's where this time in the season was really valuable.
You know, guys, everybody talks about the 8 coaches. 2 of them, of course, interim last year, Les Frazier, Jason Garrett, a little bit of a head start. But the 25 coordinators, Mangini makes an excellent point. Let's take one more quick commercial break, and we'll talk about the impact that's going to have on the game in just a moment. We've got more Pro Football Weekly for you, folks. I'm Hub Arkush, the publisher and editor. Our senior editor, Eric Edholm, is my co-host. We've been visiting with senior editor Mike Wilkening and associate editor Dan Parr. And, guys, just before the commercial, we played what I thought was kind of an interesting cut from Eric Mangini who knows a little bit about it. He's been a head coach of the Jets, head coach of the Browns, unemployed at the moment, but talked about how difficult it is for the six first-time head coaches, the two new head coaches who were interim head coaches last year, Jason Garrett and Les Frazier, and 25 new coordinators around the league. Mike, one of your teams, Cleveland, where Mangini has gone from, they got new everything there. There is going to be a tremendous imbalance in the competitive preparedness of these teams when this thing finally ends and they get back to work.
Right, and what huge sweeping changes the Browns are making. I mean, they're completely switching offensive schemes, going to a West Coast scheme with Pat Shurmur, the head coach, an offense that's going to really get the outside receivers more involved. And they're going from a 3-4 to a 4-3, and you look at their roster, they have some real needs to fill, particularly along the defensive line. So what do we have right now? We have the Browns working out the camp cult sessions, in various places, the latest set being here in Austin, Texas. And look, I mean, this is a team I think that has good player leadership, but really the on-field schooling that you need in these scheme changes, they're not getting right now. So you have to wonder about, these Cleveland Browns, where they're going to be at the beginning of next season.
Dan, you've got the NFC South, and of course, you talk about a bunch of teams in the Falcons and the Saints and the Bucks that should be in pretty good shape. But then you get to Carolina. You got poor Ron Rivera, rookie first-time head coach, couple new coordinators, and no quarterback. I know you drafted Cam Newton number one overall, but under the best of circumstances, with working 24/7 for 6 months, you might not want him starting at quarterback. I can't think of a team other than maybe the 49ers that is as big a competitive disadvantage because of this lockout right now as the Carolina Panthers.
I agree 100%, because not only do you have the questions you brought up, you have their best running back probably, D'Angelo Williams. They don't know if they'll be able to keep him or not. Not sure about his free agent status. Their best pass rusher, Charles Johnson, defensive end, coming off a breakout year. Another guy, contracts up, not sure if they'll be able to keep him or not. And then you have Cam Newton, and you have the two new schemes on both sides of the ball. Ron Rivera, first-time head coach, very experienced. But they have a lot of young players in there, a lot of unsettled positions. They don't know who will be starting and where. This team is at an incredible disadvantage, and as this negotiations continue here, they're not going to have a lot of time to figure it out whenever things do get done.
And, Eric, this brings me back to our editorial in our most recent issue of Pro Football Weekly. The owners talk about caring about the game, caring about the fans. Now, under normal circumstances, a rookie head coach would get two extra mini camps. Everybody would get one. The rookie head coaches would get three. It wouldn't be violating antitrust laws or the lockout in any way if they said, hey, in these unusual circumstances, we're going to give these eight new head coaches two meetings with as many of their players as they can get to show up to at least give them playbooks and let them know what terminology is. Why not do it if you really care about the game?
Yeah, I think they feel like any kind of weakness they show, any kind of charity they show in this situation is only going to hurt their cause. You're right. I mean, they are talking out of both sides of their mouth, which makes you wonder. But I think these first-year head coaches are going to be at a severe disadvantage.
Folks, that's everything we've got for you on the labor impasse this week. We will do this each week until we get a break. We'll keep you up to speed on everything that's happening. But unfortunately, 3 months down the road on this lockout, we're no closer to football today than we were when this whole mess started. We do have a bunch of great teams and players still in place, though. Guys who are not free agents. Lots of way we hear it for you. And we start going around the NFL right after this commercial break.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Yes, we are. And we are determined, folks, to make the best out of this mess this summer in the National Football League for you. There is still football. We love our teams. We're going to tell you about as many players as we can, and we will start continuing on with Associate Editor Dan Parr and a couple of his ball clubs. Dan, one of the big player stories this offseason has been Aqib Talib of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, now has been indicted for, I'm not sure what the specific charges are, but he fired a gun at the boyfriend of his sister. He and his mother both indicted. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers got some serious issues to deal with here because the kid's a great talent. He's got 15 picks in his first 3 years in the league. He's a lockdown cover corner who's only going to get better. He's also seriously troubled. This is one of another in a line of off the field indiscretions that he's had. And now this week we've got two of his teammates, one of them a veteran captain of the club, cornerback Rondé Barber, as well as a Pro Bowl tight end and Kellen Winslow Jr., both saying that they believe the Bucs should stick with Aqib Talib, or at least should stick with him if he is acquitted of these charges.
Yeah, and the charge on Talib, it's a felony charge of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Very serious. Could be facing prison time if convicted. it's significant that these players came out and went to bat for him. Ronnie Barber, not suggesting that he's been speaking with Raheem Morris, because I know that the rules of the lockout say that coaches and players are not supposed to communicate, and we're not suggesting that, but if anyone has an idea of where he stands on this issue, I think it's Barber. These two are very tight. He comes out and says, listen, we need to hold on to this guy if he's not convicted. He's came out in full support of Tlaib, and Winslow made an even more surprising statement to me. He said that Tlaib is as important. He is the second most important player on this team, second most valuable to Josh Freeman. High praise for him. This is a pretty significant thing that these two veterans are coming out in a time of need for Tlaib and putting themselves out there and making it clear to the organization that this is a guy the players are going to support if they do decide to keep him.
You know, Eric, it's kind of funny. I'm smiling here. A story I heard the other day. I was talking to somebody well-placed in the Bucks front office who said, you know, this whole lockout thing's got to be tough on Barber and Raheem Morris because they're very close friends. He said, you know, Barber's like a big brother to Morris because Barber's several years
yes.
older than his head coach.
Yes, he is.
So it is an interesting relationship.
Yeah, I mean, trusted advisor. I don't know what you want to call him. But, I mean, you know, Ronde Barber, especially in this team, very young in a lot of places. I mean, I think he's sort of seen as a consigliere, if you will, and you know, the Bucks need these kind of players to keep the rest of the guys in line. And I think having Ronde there is an important piece. I mean, he can go to bat for this kid. He can make sure he steps in line and make sure these kinds of things don't happen again. We're not saying he's guilty or innocent. It's just one of those situations that obviously is pretty unfortunate.
Dan, the one club you venture out of the NFC South for is you also cover the Chicago Bears. And interesting story going on there this offseason. Remember last year in training camp, they flipped starting cornerback Peanut Tillman and starting cornerback Zachary Bowman to put Bowman on the strong side where he would cover the other team's best receiver, thinking that he was their best or at least closest thing they had to a lockdown cover corner. Well, we all know how it turned out. Bowman actually lost his starting job after 3 weeks in the season, took over by Tim Jennings, a journeyman who was picked up as a free agent from the Indianapolis Colts, had been a nickel back there. Jennings, obviously not the answer. They got by with him starting all year long. And so now this offseason, Lovie Smith has said, hey, we haven't given up on Zach Bowman, but it's kind of hard to project him after what happened last year.
They're hoping Bowman comes back and kind of learned a lesson last year. He was in the doghouse all year long with Lovie Smith. They're hoping this is going to motivate him going into next year. They want him to come out and win that job. With that strong vote of confidence in training camp last year, you see how highly they think of him. After a missed tackle in that Packers game in week 3, though, he just never got back in the good graces of Lovie Smith. It's a big year for Bowman. He's heading into his contract year. Jennings, big year for him, too, his contract year. But most evaluators would tell you that Bowman should have the brighter future. It's up to him right now to go out and win that job. They're going to give him the opportunity.
Well, most evaluators will also tell you the Bears should go out and find some more people to compete at that position. Joshua Moore is a kid they took in the 5th round, I want to say, out of Kansas State, Dan, and a pretty interesting player. He was a good player who had some off-the-field issues, stayed out of trouble last year as a rookie, but really couldn't get on the field. In a normal season, he'd be part of this story, but a kid who desperately needs off-season work isn't getting any.
That's right. This is a situation where last year you saw DJ Moore, a guy who a lot of people thought was never going to pan out after a very disappointing rookie year in mini camps and OTAs. He stood out, and he came out and had a great year as the nickel corner for the Bears, surprising a lot of people. Josh Moore's not getting that opportunity. He's not able to have those OTAs and mini camps to develop and work with John Hoke, the defensive backs coach. That's going to hurt him, and we're not going to know exactly. The Bears aren't going to know exactly what they have in him when this is all done, and he could be a guy that could be a sleeper in that competition to play at cornerback, but with the situation, it's really not a good situation for him right now.
Dan, what's the latest you're hearing on the Carolina Panthers and Steve Smith, their mercurial wide receiver?
Well, Steve Smith spoke this week. He's not taking part in the player-organized workouts with the Panthers. He's tending to a health issue with his wife. He says she's okay, which we're very glad to hear, but we're still waiting to see how this is going to turn out with Steve Smith. He's not made any bold proclamations about wanting to be traded publicly. He's not saying that. He's not saying he's done as a Panther. But he's also not exactly been very careful with his words. This week he said he referred to the Panthers as they and not we, which a lot of people jumped on. I'm not going to read too much into that, but you can see that Steve and Eric Edholm have obviously done a great job reporting on this. He'd like to move on. He'd like to go out and play for a championship caliber team. And So right now he's not he's staying away from these player organized workouts.
Eric, let me ask you quickly, because Dan's reference to you doing a great job reporting on it, I know from firsthand experience as media, when you get friendly with players, it can be difficult, and yet I know you've been able to form a little bit of bond with Smith. And this guy, you know, for the last decade, one of the best receivers in the NFC, doesn't appear to be done by any stretch, but was pretty invisible last year.
Yeah, and he played hurt, but there's no question that when he noticed that he was only getting 2, 3, 4 balls thrown his way, he lost that edge that he'd always played with. He was a player who played angry, played violent, played aggressively. That edge seemed to be gone when the quarterback play went south, and he wasn't able to help himself, and his quarterbacks weren't able to help him.
All right, we take another quick commercial break here, guys. Dan Parr, thank you very much. Next up, we're going to check in with Kevin Fishbane on the AFC East, and Arthur Arkish has got some Jaguar news for us. We roll on with Pro Football Weekly on the radio. Again, Hub Arkish and Eric Edholm in studio. We are now joined on the hotline by Associate Editor Kevin Fishbane. And Kevin covers the New York Jets. And Kevin, one of the big stories this week, the release from prison of Plaxico Burress, of course, most recently a New York Giant before serving his 2+ year sentence. He is now eligible to rejoin the NFL in 2011, depending on what Commissioner Roger Goodell rules as far as whether there's any additional discipline required or not. And one of the teams that everybody is trying to connect him with is the New York Jets. What are you hearing about those possibilities?
Well, before to ignore the obvious elephant in the room of whether or not Plaxico would want to still be in the New York, New Jersey area, you know, the Jets are known for a team to bring guys like this in. I mean, you look at their roster, Antonio Cromartie, Santonio Holmes, Braylon Edwards, they have a very good support staff. And if Braylon Edwards leaves via free agency, they're going to want a tall receiver. Mark Sanchez tends to overthrow his guys periodically, and they like to have a tall receiver. But we're hearing that they are still committed to Braylon Edwards. Edwards has said he will take a discount to stay there. But if he is gone, it would make sense for the Jets to want Burress. The question then would be, would Burress want to remain in the New York area after everything that happened?
Well, based on the handgun rules in Manhattan, I'm not sure about that. But great point on Sanchez and the high throws. One guy who doesn't throw the ball very high, usually right on point, is Tom Brady. Would the Patriots be interested? I mean, they've got a ton of small receivers. I think they might reach out and grab somebody at that wide receiver position. Would they be a team that they would be interested?
Well, nothing the Patriots do has to surprise anybody anymore. And people were surprised, though, they did not draft a wide receiver. And there are talks that they will go after wide receiver in free agency. You know, they feel like they need a guy, Randy Moss-esque, that can create for himself and catch balls even when he's covered. And Burress could be that guy, but they likely would want a guy with a little more speed that's not just kind of a possession type red zone receiver that people project Burress to be when he returns.
Kevin, over and above this whole labor impasse slash lockout, there's not an owner in the NFL who has made more of a mess of his football team on the field than Stephen Ross this offseason. You got Tony Sperano now with a 2-year contract extension, even though Ross clearly wanted to get rid of him, was trying to bring in Jim Harbaugh. You've got Chad Henne, apparently still the quarterback in waiting because they didn't do anything in the draft to get excited about. And you've got both Ronnie Brown and Ricky Williams, most likely free agents. And now this week, well, they are free agents, most likely moving on. This week, I guess Ricky Williams indicated that he'd love to stay, love to win a ring in Miami, but just doesn't see it happening.
Yeah, you know, Ricky, he's from, you know, he lives there now. He loves being there. He loves being in Miami. And Ricky's the type of guy, you never know what he really wants to do. And he said that he wants to stay in Miami after his career is over as well. But at this point, from everything we've been hearing, the Dolphins and Ricky are just not going to be able to agree on a deal. They're not going to be willing to pay him a lot of money to stick around. There's a better chance they're going to hold on to Ronnie Brown. I mean, for Dolphins fans, I guess if they want Ricky, it's nice to see that he wants to stay there. But all signs are indicating that he's not going to be playing with the Dolphins next season.
All right, Kevin, thank you very much. We'll ask you to hand off the mic to Arthur Arkish, our associate editor. And Arthur, in Jacksonville, Kirk Morrison, really productive veteran linebacker. One of those guys just always a notch short of Pro Bowl type player, but very productive. And then tight end Mercedes Lewis, who some people think could have a Pro Bowl in his future. Some unusual training habits for the two this offseason, aren't there?
Well, that's correct. They've been working out in California with actually Jay Glazer from Fox Sports, who runs an MMA sort of studio workout place there. So they've been getting in a bunch of work, and I spoke with Kirk earlier this week, and he just raved about the work he's been putting in out there. He said not only from a physical standpoint, but mentally, it's really just raised his level of player. He thinks it's going to translate to a raised level of play out on the field whenever football resumes. But really, he was just excited. He had nothing but good things to say about MMA. And, you know, what was interesting is when I called Kirk and we had a chance to talk, I kind of thought that he was going to be sort of one of those guys who was maybe down on the lockout. He's an unrestricted free agent. He doesn't know where he's going to be playing next year. He had spent his whole career in Oakland prior to the draft day trade that sent him to Jacksonville last season. But he actually was pretty pumped up about the fact he's been able to do MMA work. He's been able to host a radio show with Rob Dibble on SiriusXM. And I don't want to put words in his mouth. He wasn't of the Wes Welker or the Reggie Bush vein, where he was kind of being insensitive and saying, "Oh, this lockout's the greatest thing ever." But he did say that he's had time to do things that he wouldn't be able to do otherwise this offseason, and really he said things have been going well.
Yeah, that might almost get me to apply for Sirius Radio to listen. Rob Dibble and Kirk Morris. And Morris is a great interview if anyone's ever heard him talk before. But one last point on him. He didn't have a great year last year. We got to say that. And the Jaguars defense is kind of a middling unit for the most part. Did he talk at all about his situation there in the defense and how they might improve once they do get back on the field?
He did. When he had his exit interview with GM Jim Smith and Del Rio, they said that he needed to stay close to the phone and that depending on what they did in the draft, there was a good chance he would be back. Obviously, the Jaguars did not address the linebacker position in the draft. So we're hearing there's a better chance of Morrison returning than, you know, perhaps even we were reporting earlier in this offseason before the draft. So he did say that some of his troubles last year, and he wasn't making excuses, but he did mention he was in a new defense, and of course he came over in a draft day trade, so he kind of came over late, and you know, he expects bigger things. He said that he's got a lot to prove, and there's some unfinished business to attend to down in Jacksonville.
Yeah, and a final note from Arthur's interview with Kirk Morrison. He's a big fan of Stanley Cup playoff hockey on the Rob Dibble Show. Apparently quite the analyst. Who knew? Kirk Morrison, maybe that's his future, calling hockey games. Quick commercial break here, guys. More NFL Way We Hear It coming up soon. Welcome back, everybody. We are rejoined by senior editor Mike Wilkening. And Mike, one of your ball clubs, the Pittsburgh Steelers, and their head coach, Mike Tomlin, had what I thought was a very interesting interview on KDA-TV in Pittsburgh the other day. Was talking about the, at best case, insensitive comments of his starting running back, Rashard Mendenhall, following the death of Osama bin Laden. Everybody I know has heard about it by now. He tweeted that he didn't understand how people could celebrate bin Laden's death. And Tomlin, in essence, said it was dumb. He shouldn't have said it. Yeah, it's freedom of speech, but he's a young man, and he has a right to his own opinion. He's got to be smarter. But then the point that he made is that when 9/11 occurred, Rashard Mendenhall was 12 years old and probably doesn't really grasp what a post-9/11 United States of America was in 2002, 2003. I'm not sure there's any excuse for it, but it's an interesting way for a head coach who's got to keep this kid as one of his key weapons to spin it.
Right. The big point I took away from his comments, which I totally agree with, was the thought that when a professional athlete like Rashard Mendenhall speaks, the forum that he has, those words carry a lot of weight, whether they're about football issues or non-football issues. These are guys that are looked up to, they're respected. Things about non-football issues like this that are said can create a firestorm, whether that person wants it or not. And that's exactly what happened here with Rashard Mendenhall, who again, you know, as Tomlin pointed out, a young man, a guy that I think from all accounts is an intelligent kid, someone that I think is thoughtful and is still very young. And if it's a teachable moment for all involved, then I think that the Steelers and Mendenhall can move on and it can be a good thing.
All right, Mike, hang on as I turn to Eric. And Eric, one of your clubs, the Washington Redskins, you know, it's fascinating to me that Daniel Snyder, the owner, brought in the highly respected Mike Shanahan to turn this into a football team as opposed to the soap opera or the comic book it's been the last couple of years. And yet after Shanny's first year, they may be a bigger joke than ever. And their defensive coordinator, Jim Haslett, was visiting in St. Louis, actually. Remember, he was defensive coordinator with the Rams a few years before he got to Washington. He was on the Zach and the Coach show on 101 ESPN Radio in St. Louis and had some great comments about probably the biggest punchline in the joke, Albert Haynesworth.
He's a unique individual. Most talented guy I've probably seen ever seen. He can do almost anything he wants, and he don't want to do anything. To me, that's the issue. I mean, he's one of those guys, like, if you walk into a meeting, you say, "Hey, put down the phone." The next day, you have to tell him to put down the phone. The next day, you have to tell him to put down the phone. Or, "Don't read the newspaper in meetings." And then the next day you have to tell them the same thing, and the next day you have to tell, it doesn't stick like one day, it's an everyday thing.
And I'm wondering if Daniel Snyder didn't buzz Hazlitt's cell phone mere minutes after that radio appearance. Look, they still want to trade this guy. They still think he has some league value, whatever you want to say about it. I mean, look, I think at this point cutting him is probably the best option. They really don't see him as any kind of a player in this team, and obviously those comments sort of lend towards that theory. But boy, I mean, like you said, it's really gotten kind of silly there in D.C.
Well, and I think what you take from that, I think Wilkie, talking about Mike Tomlin, used the expression teachable moment a couple minutes ago, and maybe the person this needs to be a teachable moment for is Daniel Snyder, because, Eric, everybody who knows the NFL knew the guy that he was giving $41 guaranteed million dollars to. None of what Jim Hazlitt said is news or a surprise. I guess the only people surprised about it are Daniel Snyder and maybe the now deposed Vinny Serrato.
Yeah, I mean, they pretty much negotiated against themselves. Was he considered the number one free agent in that class? Yeah, but it was a weak class. And given the fact that the only times that Albert Ainsworth had ever played up to his potential were two straight years, one when he was franchised and one when he hit free agency. So, you know, I've talked to three or four of his former teammates and coaches who all said the same thing. He's a different kind of cat. And that's exactly what Hazlitt said. You just can't count on this guy on a daily basis, which kind of dries up the market when he is let free, whether it's release or trade or what have you.
Hey, Mike, pretty quickly, if you can, I think a really interesting story out of Cleveland where general manager Tom Hecker told the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and I quote, "You can dispel that," referring to questions about the Browns trading for Eagles quarterback Kevin Kolb. He said, quote, "We are not trading for a quarterback. That one I'll say," close quote. Pretty much makes the job Colt McCoy's, doesn't it?
Right. This is going to be his job with Seneca Wallace and perhaps Jake Delhomme in reserve. But McCoy has really taken ownership of this offense. He's been the guy that's been organizing off-season workouts. He's the guy that is going to be at the helm of this West Coast offense. They didn't draft the quarterback. How long this is McCoy's job, I think, has a lot to do with 2011. We talk about the complexity and difficulty of a guy learning a new offense without the coaching staff working with him at this point. That's something McCoy's going to have to deal with. But I got to tell you, he's taken the bull by the horns at this point and has been leading the workouts.
All right, guys, thank you very much. We've got more to come. The Publisher's Pen up next.
And now with the Publisher's Pen, the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish.
Eric, one of the big football stories this week is the release of Plaxico Burress from jail, and there's two things that we need to comment on here. Number one, everybody wants to immediately make the Mike Vick comparison. The comparison is moot, folks, until we find out if Plaxico Burress is rehabilitated or not. We know he was a great football player going into jail. We know Mike Vick was. Vick has rehabilitated himself. He is trying to do the right things. Let's see if Plaxico Burress does. But here's the other interesting part of the story. We asked Kevin Fishbane about the Jets. We know the Rams are interesting. Eric, you asked him about the New England Patriots. We hear the Bears might be interested. We know, you know, there are teams that need him. But everybody's trying to put Plaxico Burress in Philadelphia because Mike Vick's there. The Eagles don't need Plaxico Burress. There'd be no reason for them to do it. They've got Jeremy Maclin, DeSean Jackson as their starting wide receivers. They've got Jason Avant in reserve. They drafted Riley Cooper. There's no fit there. But just because everybody says, well, they rehabbed one ex-con, maybe they can rehab another, it doesn't make sense, guys. And Andy Reid said this week, gosh, we haven't even thought about that yet. Don't put him in Philly just because Mike Vick is there. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. Our thanks to Randy Meyer. Randy, such a great job every week as our executive producer and engineer. Syndication Networks is our home studio and our syndicator. And most of all, guys, our thanks to all of you for listening. We appreciate it so much. Please be sure and join us again next week, same time, same station, for Pro Football Weekly.